From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, are the news media politically biased? We talk with Bernard Goldberg, author of the best-selling book Bias, which argues that the news is distorted by a liberal bias. Then we'll hear from Eric Alterman, author of the new book What Liberal Media? He says the media are more conservative than liberal. Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews the DVD release of a film that only briefly played in theaters, Donnie Darko, starring Jake Gyllenhaal. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Iraq says it agrees in principle to destroy a missile system as demanded by the chief UN weapons inspector. Linda Fasulo reports.
Hans Blix recently ordered Baghdad to start destroying the Al-Samud 2 missiles and their components by Saturday because their range limits exceed those permitted by the UN Security Council. Now, in a letter, Baghdad says it accepts the request in principle, but UN officials say it is not clear if the response represents an unconditional acceptance. Iraq has previously given mixed signals about its intentions to comply. Earlier this week, Blix said that Iraq's reaction would be an important test of its willingness to cooperate with weapons inspectors. Meanwhile, Blix just completed a new report in which he says Iraq has not made a great enough effort to account for its banned weapons programs, and as a result, its disarmament has been very limited so far. For NPR News, I'm Linda Fasulo at the United Nations.
The House has passed a measure banning all human cloning. The ban would include so-called therapeutic cloning, which is used in research to find cures for debilitating diseases. Supporters of the ban argued that allowing cloning for medical research would make it impossible to regulate cloning that could lead to the replication of a human being. Treasury Secretary John Snow joined lawmakers on Capitol Hill today to start a legislative push for President Bush's proposed tax cuts. Republican leaders say the tax-cutting legislation is bipartisan, but so far only one Democrat has signed on as a co-sponsor. NPR's David Wellner reports from the Capitol.
The lone Democrat to endorse the more than $1 trillion in new tax cuts is Georgia Senator Zell Miller.
When the roll is called on the president's tax cut, I guarantee you that I will not be the only Democrat voting for it. There will be others, just as there was back in 2001.
Still, Republicans and Democrats who voted for the 2001 tax cut at a time of projected budget surpluses have expressed strong reservations about cutting taxes now that big deficits have returned. South Dakota Democratic Senator Tim Johnson says these tax cuts are for the president's big campaign contributors.
Shame on the president for these kinds of priorities. America deserves better.
It could be months before Congress votes on the tax cuts. David Wellner, NPR News, the Capitol.
The Israeli parliament has approved the new right-wing government formed by Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. In addition to Sharon's Likud party, the coalition consists of a party that supports Jewish settlers in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, and a party that believes there's no point in renewing peace talks with the Palestinians while Yasser Arafat is their leader. In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 78 points, or 1%, to close at 7,884 in heavy trading. Advances led declines by more than 2-1. The Nasdaq gained 20 points to close at 1,324. This is NPR News. Children's television personality Fred Rogers died today at his home in Pittsburgh. He was 74 years old. Kim Kokich reports.
Fred Rogers spent more than 30 years as the host of public television's Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. An ordained minister, he never wavered from his simple message to love thy neighbor as thyself. Action for Children's Television founder Peggy Charon says Rogers' patient approach was unique.
Mr. Rogers demonstrated that you have to talk in a different voice when you're talking to children, that you have to treat children like people who need to know the answers to questions. Mr. Rogers used to think of the questions that children needed to know the answer to before the children knew it themselves.
Fred Rogers was diagnosed with stomach cancer and succumbed to the disease at his home surrounded by members of his family. For NPR News, I'm Kim Kokich in Washington.
The Bush administration has lowered the nation's terrorism alert level to yellow after nearly 3 weeks at the high risk or orange level. Attorney General John Ashcroft and Homeland Security Secretary Tom Ridge cautioned that there's still a risk of attack. They issued a joint statement warning that al-Qaeda will wait until it believes Americans are less vigilant and less prepared before it will strike again. The statement called on Americans to remain defiant and alert. Ashcroft and Ridge said one reason for reducing the level of the alert was the end of the Hajj, the Muslim time of pilgrimage. Senate Democrats criticized the color-coded alert system, saying it's confusing and costly for local jurisdictions that have to pay for increased security. In stocks today, the S&P 500 gained 9 points to close at 837. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
The NPR online shop features a variety of NPR-related merchandise, including the All Songs Considered compact disc series, on the NPR website, npr.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Do the news media have a conservative bias, as Bernard Goldberg asserts in his best-selling book? Or are the media more conservative than liberal, as Eric Alterman says in his new book, What Liberal Media? We're asking Goldberg and Alterman to each make his case. First, Bernard Goldberg. His book, Bias, was a number one bestseller when it was published in hardcover. Now it's on the paperback bestseller list. Goldberg looks primarily at network TV news. He was a reporter and producer for the CBS Evening News for nearly 30 years. In 1996, he wrote an op-ed piece for the Wall Street Journal in which he cited a report that had recently run on the CBS Evening News to illustrate what he sees as a liberal bias in the news. He left the network 4 years later. Goldberg says there's not a well-orchestrated, vast left-wing conspiracy in America's newsrooms. Here's what he says is happening.
What happens, and the way media bias works, I think, is like this. The media elites live in places basically like New York and Washington. They go to dinner parties and cocktail parties and socialize with their smart, sophisticated liberal friends in New York and Washington. Their newsrooms are populated by like-minded people on many, many of the social issues, whether it's feminism, race, gay rights, even homelessness, things like that. After a while, the media elites, while they're able to spot a conservative point of view 10,000 miles away through brick walls, they really think that their views aren't liberal on these issues. They think their views are reasonable, are mainstream, are moderate. And they think that because, well, all their friends think that way on those issues. That's the nature of liberal bias in the news. It's not a conspiracy. It's not something that they come in the morning and are determined to accomplish. But it is a kind of groupthink. And in that sense, it's not a good thing because I think you could hook my friend Dan Rather up to a lie detector machine, ask him if there's a liberal bias in the news. Even from time to time on the newscast, he'd say no, and I don't think the needle would budge.
Well, give me an example of a program or a network or an individual who you think displays this type of media bias that you're describing.
Well, I don't think ABC, NBC, or CBS are really that much different from each other. I just think it's who they are. It's part of the mindset. Let's take a subject like abortion. A very controversial subject. Americans are split on it. Yet when political reporters report about abortion, they say correctly, by the way, correctly, they say that Republicans have to appeal to the anti-abortion people on the right in the primaries, and then the Republicans have a real problem getting back to the middle to appeal to the broader electorate in the general election. They're right about that. But Democrats have the exact same problem, but it's never put that way. Not long ago, six Democratic presidential candidates went to a NARAL Pro-Choice America, the biggest pro-abortion lobby in America that supports abortion without restrictions, and they appealed to those people. But a recent Gallup poll shows that only something like 24% of the American people fit into that category of abortion without restrictions. But the reporters who reported about that didn't say Democrats who appeal to the left wing of the Democratic Party are going to have a problem when they go into a general election because most voters are not for abortion on demand. It's framed the default position, Terry. Let me put it that way. The default position is that Republicans and conservatives have the problem with abortion in America. Liberals and Democrats don't because liberals and Democrats on abortion are mainstream. Republicans and conservatives are not mainstream. Factually, that's just not true.
Your book about liberal bias has been a number one bestseller, but a lot of people say, well, the opposite is true. If the media has a bias, it's a conservative bias.
Yeah.
And those people would say, look at talk radio, look at Rush Limbaugh, Gordon Liddy, Oliver North, Sean Hannity, Neil Bortz, Bob Grant, Michael Medved. So what's your response to the people who say if there's a bias, it's really a conservative bias in the media?
Well, there's no question that when it comes to the world of opinion, conservatives are not shrinking violets. There's no question about that. The talk radio is dominated by conservatives. Absolutely true. But there's a difference between talk radio and talk television, for that matter, which is what Bill O'Reilly does and Sean Hannity on television do, and news, straight news, allegedly, supposedly objective news. I don't have a problem if everybody on talk radio were liberal. The marketplace is going to determine that. But I do think this. I think if it weren't for a feeling in much of America, among millions and millions of Americans, that the mainstream media, the media that's supposed to give it to them straight, and they don't confuse that, I don't think, with talk radio, where they understand that that's an opinion medium. If the mainstream medium were only giving it to them straight, I'm not sure that there'd be a Fox News channel, for instance. I think Fox News is the direct result, and its growing success certainly is the direct result of a disillusionment with the way the mainstream media is operating. So I think, yes, there's no question that in talk radio and on Fox, there's a conservative attitude and a conservative slant and whatever you want to call it. But power comes from numbers in the media. And Fox has about a million viewers a night, and the CBS Evening News, ABC, NBC, and PBS Evening Newscast combined have about 35 million viewers a night. I'm not all that worried about Fox, which is a talk opinion program in the evening, but I'm more concerned about 35 million people watching a supposedly objective newscast and not always getting it that way.
Let me quote something that Neil Gabler said in response to the whole debate about whether the media has a liberal or a conservative bias. He said, the real media war today isn't between liberals and conservatives, but between two entirely different journalistic mindsets, those who believe in advocacy and those who believe in objectivity, or at least the appearance of objectivity. What do you think?
Well, I'll use me as an example. I believe in objectivity. I don't want a conservative newscast. I don't want CBS News to take a poll and say, since our ratings have been slipping, let's find out what the American people want. And if they want a conservative newscast, we'll give it to them. So the debate among some people may be the way Neil Gabler described it. But I just want a newscast. I just want a newscast that has more views from various points on the spectrum. We get intelligent liberal views. How about a few more intelligent conservative views? I think that's really the nature of the problem. But I'm willing to accept, and I'll say for argument's sake, I'm willing to accept, I'm just dead wrong about all of this. I tried to get it right, but I got it all wrong. Here's the real problem for the media elites, the real problem for Rather, Brokaw, Jennings, and people at the New York Times like Hal Raines. Millions and millions and millions of Americans think I got it right. I'm not a Svengali. Believe me, I don't go out there and hypnotize people to either buy books or to agree with me. They just do because it resonates. And they do, actually, because I caught up with many of them. I mean, they didn't catch up with me. So even if I'm wrong, then I can be dismissed. I don't have a problem with that. But what are the media elites going to do with those millions and millions and millions of Americans who also think the way I do on this issue? Sooner or later, and this is crucial, sooner or later, the people at the networks are going to have to deal with those people because they continue to lose viewers. And at some point, they'll either deal with them and address the issues and not ignore this whole problem, or they'll become less and less relevant.
Do you think that the success of your book shows something that might not be what you think it shows? And here's what I'm thinking. A lot of people seem to really enjoy news as sport, news as opinion, news as argument, as demonstrated by all of the point-counterpoint kind of shows where you've got two people from opposite sides who are kind of battling out every issue through the evening. And you have shows like that on CNN. There's, you know, a lot of interviews like that on MSNBC. Fox certainly has plenty of, opinion journalism. And your book is opinion journalism in the sense that, you know, you're giving your opinions. The book is very much about what you think. It's about your opinion. Maybe, if you're arguing that the network news is losing listenership, is losing viewers, maybe it's losing viewers because people would rather have more opinion. Maybe it's not because they're biased. Maybe it's because they're not opinionated enough for people who are so used to opinion journalism.
Well, it's true that we live in the United States of entertainment. And people, for whatever reason, need conflict. It's like television is like literature, but not necessarily good literature. It's like everything has to have a conflict, good guys, bad guys. So you're definitely onto something there. But the arguments in the book that I make, yes, of course they're my opinion, just as the arguments in anybody's book, you know, are those person's opinions. But I don't think if I had argued the opposite, if I had argued, for instance, that people who say there's a liberal bias in the news are right-wing dolts who are taking their marching orders from people like Rush Limbaugh, I don't think the book would have been successful because I don't think that's what so many Americans actually believe.
But I guess what I'm asking is, do you think that your book in its own way is increasing this climate of opinion journalism, where people like the fight, they like the controversy, and maybe even become less interested in the journalism of fairness, the journalism of just examining, right. You know, gathering facts and examining all the points of view and presenting them?
Yeah, that's a very good point. That is, you know, I'd love to say, I don't know what you're talking about, but I do. And it's a very good point, and it's certainly possible. I tried to make the book entertaining. I admit that. At least I acknowledge it. Admit implies some, you know, guilt along the way. I acknowledge that I tried to make the book entertaining, but I tell real stories about how we cover AIDS and how we cover homelessness and how we cover racial issues. There's a danger, though. You're absolutely right. There's a danger that if something isn't entertaining in this country, it doesn't survive. I think everything in the mass media has to be entertaining at some level. If it's simply dry statistics, no matter how intelligent it is, this isn't my fault. This is just the way it is. It's not going to work. If it isn't entertaining, it dies sooner or later, and usually sooner.
My guest is Bernard Goldberg, author of the book Bias. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Bernard Goldberg, author of the bestseller Bias, in which he argues that the news media have a liberal bias. Goldberg is a former reporter and producer for CBS News. Could you choose an issue, a major issue in the news, possible war with Iraq, Bush economic plan, some like really major front and center issue in the news that you think has been handled with bias by most of the media?
Whenever a story about AIDS comes up, I just wait for the bias to come out. If even one person in America or any place in the world has AIDS, it's a terrible, terrible, terrible tragedy. I mean, that I hope goes without saying. But what the media started to do 20 years ago, but continues to do today, is that it tells us that AIDS isn't just a disease in the United States, I'm talking about, in the United States. It's not just a disease of gay men and junkies. AIDS is everybody's disease. This is how it started in the 1980s. They said AIDS was a disease where everybody is at risk. And they managed to create an epidemic of fear. And the fear was that heterosexuals, and not just heterosexuals who were having sex with junkies, but heterosexual Americans were the next big wave. We were told that 1 in 5 Americans would be dead by the year 2000, and just a bunch of insane things. Well, the media has never corrected that. That didn't happen. All you have to do is look around and say, well, where are all these dead heterosexuals? They're not in my newsroom. They're not on my block. Where are they? And they've had every chance to correct that. But whenever they do a story, I mean, I'll bet you if you go out and did a poll right now and ask mainstream America, do you think heterosexuals are at high risk for getting AIDS if they have, quote, unquote, unsafe sex with other heterosexuals? They'd say yes. But it isn't true.
You work under the assumption that a lot of the reporters in the press are liberals, and that even if they try to be fair, their bias will express itself in their reporting. Do you think it's possible for a journalist to have a political point of view and yet to believe so much in the profession of journalism and in the code of impartiality for reporters that they are doing a very fair and balanced job in spite of the fact that they may have a point of view?
Yeah, a couple of things. First, it's not my feeling that most journalists at big news organizations are liberal. It's their feeling. The Los Angeles Times has done a poll. All sorts of people have done polls on this where they ask journalists to identify themselves. And on issues from abortion to guns to death penalty and affirmative action and all sorts of things, they come down on a side that's more liberal than the American people. So that's not like my opinion that they're liberal. Do I think that they can put that, whatever their politics are, aside and cover the news because that's what journalists are supposed to do? Yeah, I think they can, and I think sometimes they do. What I'm saying is when you have so many like-minded people in the newsroom, even when you try to do the right thing, and I've never said that they don't try to do the right thing, it's just difficult. Let me give you an example, Terry, involving guns. A while back, there was a rampage at a law school at a law school in the western part of Virginia, and the rampage involved a student who had a gun and shot and killed several other students and wounded others, and he was on a rampage and he probably would have killed and wounded a whole bunch more, except that three students went to their cars, two of whom had guns, and two of these students went back and used their guns to subdue the gunman, the one who was killing the students. I spoke to one of those students who had a gun, and he said he told that story, the one I just told you, to 50 to 100 reporters, and yet virtually none of them. I did a Nexus search. I could only find 4 stories that mentioned that the students who subdued the gunman also had guns. Now, why is that? I mean, that's strange. That's monumentally bad journalism, since that's a crucial part of the story. It explains how the rampage ended. Well, perhaps if there were more journalists out there who, and I'm not a gun person, for whatever that's worth. I don't like guns. I don't like having them around. I don't like looking at them. But if there were more journalists who weren't liberal on the issue of guns, and more journalists in the newsroom who were conservative and thought that, well, guns aren't a bad thing necessarily, then that story would have come out right. And they couldn't have made the mistake honestly. I mean, I do believe that most mistakes are honest mistakes. But that one, they had to consciously decide to leave out such a crucial piece of information. And I think I'm connecting the dots here. I don't have absolute proof, but I think it's a safe bet that they left out that crucial piece of information because here was an example of someone using a gun to do something good, and that didn't fit the preconceived notions. And that's where much of the bias in the media comes in. They're based on preconceived notions. How are we supposed to feel about certain issues? If it's homelessness, well, we're supposed to feel that they look just like you and me, even though they don't look just like you and me. Things like that.
I don't want to make this about NPR, but I'm just curious, where do you think NPR fits in your charge of liberal bias?
Well, I think NPR does a lot of very interesting and intelligent things, so I don't have a problem with that. If I have a problem with NPR is that they'll devote 10 minutes to a fascinating subject, and then they'll also devote 10 minutes to somebody who's planting petunias, you know, in her backyard. So I find some of it not especially interesting, but I find that that's not a wrap. I mean, that's true in a lot of places. Ideologically, conservatives certainly think that NPR is a liberal network and the talk shows are liberal. As a matter of fact, when liberals started complaining about conservative talk radio and said, we need our own liberal network, my two or three conservative friends said, what do you think NPR is? And I do think, certainly on talk shows, there's some truth to that. And I've been on about 400 radio shows around the country and a couple of local NPR shows. And I will tell you, Terry, they are demonstrably different than the other talk shows that I've been on. Ideologically speaking. So, yeah, there's certainly a lot on NPR that tilts to the left, but I also think there's an awful lot of very, very good stuff and intelligent stuff and stuff that goes more than a minute and a half on NPR, and it serves a great purpose.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry, for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to try to get some of my points out.
Bernard Goldberg is the author of the bestseller Bias. We'll hear from the author of a new book that responds to Goldberg's book in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And by Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Blue Poppies, a novel set in 1950s Tibet by Jonathan Falla. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more on bias and the news. We talk with Eric Alterman. His new book, What Liberal Media, argues that the media are more conservative than liberal. And film critic David Edelstein reviews the DVD release of a cult film which only briefly played theaters, Donnie Darko, starring Jake Gyllenhaal. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the new book, What Liberal Media? The Truth About Bias in the News, Eric Alterman responds to Bernard Goldberg and others who argue that the media have a liberal bias. Alterman thinks that idea is just a myth, and it's a myth that empowers conservatives to control the debate in the United States to the point where liberals can't even hope for a fair shake anymore. Alterman writes the Stop the Press's media column for The Nation and the Altercation weblog for MSNBC.com. He's also the author of a book about media pundits called Sound and Fury, The Making of the Punditocracy. I asked him to describe the bias that he perceives in the news.
I basically share the view that many conservatives have that most elite journalists are social liberals. But I feel that they're economic conservatives. In fact, I think I demonstrate with evidence, which is something some of these other books don't bother with, that they're economic conservatives. But on the social liberal side, there's a whole conservative structure and an economic structure in the media that keeps journalists' biases in check. So you hear very little of them. In fact, more often than not, I think journalists bend over backwards to denude themselves of their biases because they're trying to be objective. With the economic biases, there's no such structure. Everything about journalism, the fact that we have a strong conservative movement, the fact that we have very tiny number of enormous corporate owners, the fact that business is the way we think about the world. NPR doesn't have labor shows. It's got business shows, and that's NPR. So I think everything on the economic side reinforces journalists' economic conservatism, whereas it pushes in the opposite direction of their social liberalism.
Okay, let me ask you about the social liberalism for a second. So you feel confident that most journalists are, in fact, social liberals.
Well, look.
Is that like a feeling or is that based on a poll?
I don't really trust the polls very much. There's one poll that that people are always waving around that 89% of Washington journalists voted for Bill Clinton in 1992. It's a bad poll and I don't believe it. But I nevertheless think its thrust is probably accurate. Not the poll itself. It's consistent. Look, I live on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. I used to live in DuPont Circle in Washington for 8 or 10 years. Everybody I know pretty much supports a woman's right to choose, supports gays' rights to marry and raise children. They support gun control. They support campaign finance. There's no dissension on these points. But like I said, these views are... journalists don't feel free to preach these views, in part because there's an enormous conservative structure ready to pounce on them if ever they hear them, but also in part because journalists want to be professionals. They want to be objective. In 1990, I believe, David Shaw of the LA Times published an enormous series media criticism in which he dissected the coverage of the abortion issue. And he felt that it leaned very far in favor of pro-choice advocates, that there was a lot of sort of coded messages and that the anti-abortion side or pro-life side was being treated unfairly. This series won a Pulitzer Prize from the so-called liberal media, and it had an enormous effect on people's perception of the coverage so that they tried to fix the problems that he identified. They weren't trying to secretly give out these messages the way conservatives imagine. They were trying to do their job. And yeah, sure, prejudices get involved in every report because the mere act of committing journalism is to invoke your own prejudices.
Now, let me ask you about a point that Bernard Goldberg makes. He says that when it comes to certain social issues, that liberals see their point of view as not being a point of view as much as just being a civilized way to think. On such issues as being pro-choice on abortion, being for gun control, being for gay rights, and being for feminism. Goldberg is saying liberal journalists don't see that as a political point of view much as they see it as just a civilized point of view to have, a point of view everybody should have.
Yeah, I think that was true in the 1960s and the 1970s. And I think, for instance... Barry Goldwater and Richard Nixon had a real problem with the media in that regard. But I think that the tide has turned. I think Goldberg is 20, 30 years out of date. And I think that journalists that conservatives who make this charge are either not paying attention or they're being deliberately strategic. One might even say dishonest, because it has such a powerful effect on journalists when they make this complaint. I'll tell you the truth. I think what conservatives really object to in the so-called liberal media is that they feel that the media are looking down on them. They feel that these guys like Dan Rather and Tom Brokaw and Peter Jennings, and by the way, that's really all Goldberg's book is about, and he'll say so. His book is about the three evening newscasts, and 72 pages out of 200 have the word Dan Rather on them, and none of them are very nice. I think what these people really object to is that they perceive a kind of condescension towards their lives on the part of the liberal media, the so-called liberal media. Not that it's not political, it's social and cultural. And I actually think they may be right about that. And there's nothing journalists can do about that. They do live in a different world. I mean, Dan Rather and Brokaw, they make $10 million a year, and they, you know, they worry about co-ops in Aspen and in the Caribbean. They don't worry about making payments in public schools and so forth. And I fear that my objection to this is that the conservatives, particularly on talk radio, but also on cable TV, they exploit this feeling and put it in the service of a economic and political agenda that actually hurts the interests of the people that they're alleged to be speaking for. I wish liberals could find their own populist voice and speak for these people and address their cultural concerns and put it at the service of a political agenda, which I feel would advance their interests rather than retard them.
In looking at whether the media has a bias, you say conservatives are extremely well represented in every facet of the media. Make your case on that.
Well, look, take a look at talk radio, which approximately 40 million Americans say they get their news from, and 15 to 20 million alone get their news from Rush Limbaugh. There's about as much ideological variety in American talk radio today as there was in the Soviet Communist Party of 1934 under Joseph Stalin. It's no joke to say that Bill O'Reilly is a liberal by the standards of American talk radio. And that's only because O'Reilly admits that global warming is taking place, but he doesn't think we should do anything about it. And he's against the death penalty because he thinks that criminals should suffer longer. He thinks death penalty is too nice. That's what a liberal is by talk radio standards. Now that Phil Donahue has been canceled, there is no liberal on cable TV with his own show. There are a few liberals who are play the liberal against a conservative. Except in the case of Crossfire, I would say most of these liberals are getting beaten up by the conservatives they're playing against. The conservatives are much tougher, much stronger, much more outspoken than the liberals that they're pitted against. So if talk radio is 100% far right, then cable TV is about 85% conservative, and it's very conservative. It's not just a little bit conservative. On broadcast TV, the only people who are empowered to give their opinions on a regular basis, as I can tell, are George Will and John Stossel of ABC News, both quite conservative. No liberals at all. If you look at print, if you look at the most articulate liberals in print, there's not as many of them as there are conservatives. The Washington Post has far more conservatives than they do liberals, for instance. The New York Times is a little bit more liberal than conservative. But almost all of the conservatives, I suppose the only exception I can think of off the top of my head is William Sapphire of well-known people, and that's because the Times has a policy on this. They don't allow their people to be regulars on TV. All the conservatives are on TV who write conservative columns. None of the liberals are. None of the well-known liberals, like I said, Hertzberg, Dionne, Paul Krugman, Richard Cohen, William Grider of The Nation, none of them have regular TV slots, but just about every conservative does. Robert Novak alone has more TV slots than all these guys put together. So I think that in the opinion media, and actually, to tell you the truth, I don't get all that much argument from conservatives on this. In the opinion media, it's almost entirely conservative dominated. And they have various reasons why this is the case. They say they're just better at TV and their talent pool is larger, and that's why. But the conservatives, as you can see with Goldberg, tend to make their case with regard to what they see as the biases of allegedly objective reporting because they know they have the opinion media sewn up, the punditocracy.
And do you agree with any of those charges that the reporters in newspapers or in broadcast have a liberal bias in their reporting?
No. I do, as I said, agree that they have socially liberal views. But I think that those views are stripped from most of the reporting. I mean, you can always find examples of this, either side of bias, if you spend all day looking for them. There's nothing. If you know, an organization like Brent Bozell's Media Research Center, which looks for this kind of thing on the right, and Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, which looks for it on the left, These people are not going to be out of work because it's impossible to denude yourself of biases. Like I said, the mere act of choosing what story you're going to present and from what perspective you're going to present it without even thinking about politics is an act of bias. And someone can tell you why that's biased. I argue in the book that the entire structure of business reporting is biased against labor. When the New York Times reports that corporations have reduced the cost of production, they're not paying attention to the fact that jobs are being shipped overseas, that these quote-unquote externalities like pollution are being downloaded onto the people in the communities, that workers are losing their health care, their pension rights, so forth. These would be stories that people that would be reported if the entire structure of the media were not biased towards business over labor. So even when we're not, I would make the argument that on economic news, the unspoken bias is definitely towards the right, and that on social issues like gay rights and abortion, there's an enormous effort on journalists to include people and points of view that they don't share, to the point where it's sometimes silly.
My guest is Eric Alterman, author of the new book, What Liberal Media? We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Eric Alterman is my guest. He's the author of the new book, What Liberal Media? The Truth About Bias and the News. I think it's fair to say that in certain political stories, you think that the press tends to favor conservatives over liberals, Republicans over Democrats. As an example, you think that President Bush has received much easier coverage than President Clinton has.
Yeah, no question about that in my mind. And I also think that the coverage of the 2000 election was egregiously slanted against Al Gore in a way that even as someone who covered that, covered the media coverage of that election, not just the election, it was my beat, the media coverage, for both The Nation and MSNBC. But when I went back to look at it, I was shocked at how egregiously Al Gore's positions were manipulated and
Well, let me ask you about Gore. Do you think that was a result of a conservative bias or something more personal, that people just didn't like, people in the press didn't like Gore?
Well, I know that people in the press didn't like Gore. They hated Al Gore. It wasn't just didn't like him. There's an incident described in the book. I didn't see it, but it was reported in Time magazine, where during a debate between Gore and Bradley, the people in the press room actually stood up and screamed and jeered at the screen when Gore came on. I mean, you would think that they would at least try to hide it. I don't think it was ideological in the case with Gore. I think they hated Clinton. Clinton was incredibly charming in terms of the way he manipulated the press and seduced the press. But the day after Clinton became president, he shut the door of the White House and he decided he hated the press and he wanted nothing more to do with them. And they turned on him with an incredible degree of ferocity to the point where you know, the president's sex life, which all presidents have had a right to in the past, became the most important issue that the country was facing in a way that the rest of the world just couldn't fathom it. I mean, here Ronald Reagan and George Bush Sr. and George W. Bush, current president, have all felt empowered to lie to the nation about matters of war and peace. You can call it a lie, you can call it misleading, you can perhaps in the case of Reagan and maybe even George W. Bush, you could be charitable and say they're misleading themselves as well. But they're saying a lot of things that aren't true, and they were getting away with it then, and Bush is getting away with it now. Whereas with Bill Clinton, we basically stopped the entire business of the American government to impeach a man for saying something that millions of Americans have done, which is lie about adultery, and many presidents had done before him. Take the example of Whitewater. The Clintons lost $30,000 on a real estate investment. We spent $70 million investigating it. There were thousands and thousands of stories written about it. What about George Bush and Harkin Oil, where he made millions? That story came and went in 2 weeks. What about the fact that George Bush may have deserted his his National Guard post for a year. We don't know what happened there. What about the fact that George Bush may have used cocaine? We don't know what happened there either. Now, personally, Terry, I have to tell you, I don't really care about any of these things, whether or not George Bush did them years ago. I only care about what the president does while he's president. But if you compare the incredible amount of resources and energy and excitement that was poured into investigating Bill Clinton's past life, things that had nothing whatsoever to do with the presidency, and what George Bush was able to get away with before he was president and is able to get away with today, I don't see how you can conclude anything but that the press is much more sympathetic to a Republican conservative than they are to a moderate Democrat.
I don't want to make this about National Public Radio, which is the network that Fresh Air is on, but I would like to hear if you think that NPR has a political bias.
I'll tell you what I think, Terry. I think that I don't think there are many conservatives working at NPR. I think most people at NPR are either liberals or just honest down-the-line journalists. And I think they try and do down-the-line journalism, and they're extremely sensitive, particularly since they're publicly funded, to this right-wing concerted attack on both NPR and PBS that's been going on for the past 20 or 30 years. So I think that, left alone, NPR probably would have a liberal bias. But I think NPR has been enormously sensitive and enormously careful as a result of this conservative attack. I think the conservatives actually have a right to declare victory vis-a-vis NPR because they've succeeded in getting their point of view well represented by people who don't share it. And NPR is sort of a perfect example of what I was talking about earlier, where social liberals, I imagine everybody at NPR feels basically the same way about abortion and gay rights and so forth. But I think it bends over backwards to be more than fair to conservatives. And I think this notion that I heard when I was on Bill O'Reilly's show last week, that, okay, the right has Rush Limbaugh and Michael Savage and Fox News and the Wall Street Journal, and the left has NPR, is just ridiculous. Because NPR is specifically not in the business of political advocacy. It's in the business of trying to address all points of view. And to my mind, lately, it bends over too far to the right. When Bernard Goldberg was on, when his book came out a year ago, the discussion was between two conservatives and two mainstream journalists. No liberals were invited into that discussion, just the way it's done in the mainstream media. So I think that, NPR has kind of a social and cultural bias, which it works hard to address, but it's in no way comparable to the naked and rather aggressive and open bias that is dominating the American discourse and coming from an extremely well-funded right.
Your book challenges the charges that there's a liberal bias in the media. Within your book, you also talk about another issue that a lot of journalists face, which is that a lot of newspapers, TV stations, radio stations are owned by large corporate interests. Do you think that that's an issue that affects news coverage?
Absolutely, Terry. I think there's relatively few examples of explicit corporate censorship of journalists, although there are some, and I talk about them in the book. They seem to. There's one that, involving Disney, or one or two involving Disney, they seem to be actually the people who do this the worst. There's some accusations about the 2000 election and Jack Welch and NBC, GE, that have never been proven, and they may or may not be true. But more important, I think they set a tone for journalists who know better than to go into certain areas, who know better than to write stories that are going to hurt their corporate parents. Michael Kinsley did us all the great favor of admitting that you should never look for an investigative story about Microsoft in Slate magazine. The same is true just about everywhere else, in terms of you're not going to look for NBC to investigate GE. You're not going to look for Disney to investigate Disney. You're not going to look for the New York Post to investigate Rupert Murdoch. But it's actually worse than that, because there are 150 or so. I have no idea how many companies there are under AOL Time Warner. There's more than I can count. And they all have their own interests, and they all have executives who have girlfriends, who have friends. And it has an enormously chilling effect on journalists in the stories they choose to write and choose not to write. Something like 40% of journalists, and according to a Columbia Journalism Review survey, admitted to practicing self-censorship, mostly on this very issue, on not wanting to upset either advertisers or their parent corporation. So the fact that six companies, and this is no exaggeration, six companies control just about all of the media right now, And that's actually one reason why independent voices, believe it or not, like the New York Times and of course, NPR, are so much more valuable. The fact that only six companies control so much of the media, it makes it that much more difficult for journalists to find stories that don't in some way involve their own corporation. And it leads to it leads in part to more pablum and more white bread reporting, and in part to emphasis on stories that are meaningless, tabloid-type stories about phony kidnapping of blonde-haired children and so forth, because these kinds of stories don't get anybody in trouble.
Eric Alterman is the author of the new book, What Liberal Media? He writes the Stop the Press's media column for The Nation. Earlier, we heard from Bernard Goldberg, whose book Bias argues that the news media have a liberal bias. Coming up, film critic David Edelstein reviews the DVD release of a film which only briefly played in theaters, Donnie Darko, starring Jake Gyllenhaal. This is Fresh Air. Film critic David Edelstein has a review of a low-budget independent film he figures you probably didn't get to see in theaters. The film Donnie Darko, which stars Jake Gyllenhaal, had a very limited run when it opened in the fall of 2001, but it developed a cult following through cable showings and through video and DVD rentals. This month, the DVD became available for purchase.
Wake up.
That voice belongs to a 6-foot-tall rabbit called Frank, who is either an emissary of God or a sure sign that our suburban high school hero, Donnie Darko, is a delusional schizophrenic. The rabbit wakes Donnie up at midnight on October 2, 1988, and tells him to leave his house. A few moments later, a jet engine of unknown origin falls through the roof above his room. Donnie has been saved, yet he is doomed. The rabbit says the world will end in 28 days, 6 hours, 42 minutes, 12 seconds. Increasingly, there are signs that Donnie has entered a tangent universe, that the time-space continuum has been ruptured. Or maybe he's just nuts. I saw Donnie Darko at the end of its brief theatrical run in the fall of 2001, and I wasn't sure what Donnie was. All I knew was that I loved him, and I loved the movie around him, too. But I think I needed to live with it a while, let it ferment, watch it again on cable, watch it again on DVD. Now I think it could be one of the great cult DVDs of all time. The movie is a genre bender. It's John Hughes' teen angst with a jolt of Stephen King. No, it's much better than that. It's Catcher in the Rye with time twists out of Philip K. Dick. No, that makes it sound too sci-fi, whereas the movie is funny and romantic and generally down to earth. It's a family drama, a comic book superhero saga, a passionate religious parable. It's all over the map. It shouldn't gel. But it's so tenderly written, so lyrically photographed by Stephen Poster, so gorgeously acted, that its youthful overreaching doesn't matter. It's as if the writer-director Richard Kelly packed the entire spectrum of his adolescent thoughts and feelings into a single movie. The books he read in high school and summer camp, the mope rock he heard on the radio, the changes he felt in his body, the anxiety dreams, the sex dreams, the superhero fantasies. Donnie Darko is finally nothing less than a teenage enquiry into the existence of God. It explicitly poses the question, does every living creature on earth die alone? Here's Donnie, played by Jake Gyllenhaal, pressing his science teacher, played by Noah Wiley, on the subject of time travel. Donnie has begun to see watery spears like slinkies emerge from people's chests and dart ahead of them, tracing the path they're going to take in the next few seconds. He wants to know, badly, what it says about predestination.
Well, each vessel travels along a vector through space-time along its center of gravity.
Like a spear.
I beg your pardon?
Like a spear that comes out of your chest.
Sure, yeah. And in order for the vessel to travel through time, it's got to find a porthole, or in this case, a wormhole, or...
Well, could these portals just appear anywhere, anytime?
I think that's highly unlikely. No, I think what you're talking about is an act of God.
Well, if God controls time, then all time's predecided.
I'm not following you.
Look, every living thing follows along set path. And if you could see your path or channel, then you could see into the future, right? That's a form of time travel.
Well, you're contradicting yourself, Donnie. If we were able to see our destinies manifest themselves visually, then we would be given a choice to betray our chosen destinies. And the mere fact that this choice exists would make all preformed destiny come to an end.
Not if you travel within God's channel.
I don't know how to praise Jake Gyllenhaal enough, except to say that he embodies the titanic contradictions of every teen. His Donnie is crazy, yet burningly lucid. At times, he has the satanic cast of Malcolm McDowell in A Clockwork Orange, yet he also has the sweet and dopey earnestness of Tobey Maguire in Spider-Man. The DVD has two engaging but problematic commentaries, one with Kelly and Jake Gyllenhaal, the other with Kelly and the cast, including Drew Barrymore, who is also the movie's executive producer and guardian angel. It also boasts many deleted scenes, which tend to pin down the symbolism too firmly. I think they were well discarded, but Kelly doesn't, and the more he talks about what the movie means, the more you want to turn off the commentary. His unconscious instincts are just so much more fascinating than his conscious explanations, and the movie is richer for its ambiguities. What finally makes this such a great movie for DVD is that you'll want to see it over and over again, to take it apart and put it back together. And even if the time travel pieces don't all fit, the puzzle still makes your synapses hum. No movie has ever captured adolescent self-pity in a way that makes it quite so mythic.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the internet at www.burrells.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Harcourt, publisher of The Blind Man of Seville, a murder mystery that leads a detective to the seamy side of his famous father's life, by Robert Wilson, author of A Small Death in Lisbon. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, we remember Fred Rogers and listen back to an interview with him. Rogers has died of cancer at the age of 74. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.